Dirty hands means clean theology. Can you dig it?
To all my guys and gals and long distance pals, we're back.
We are back.
We are.
And Ben's actually with us today. I'm excited. I know it.
It's been a while.
We're down Justin and up a Ben. Eventually, we'll all three be able to get together again.
Hopefully soon.
I'm looking forward to it. We got to get together in person again. This time, we're doing it remote. I much prefer when we're all together. It's a good time.
Good fellowship time.
It is a good fellowship time. You know, where two or three are gathered in his name, there he is. And that's what this is all about. So,
yes, sir.
Well, today we're going to keep on rolling with our Genesis Bible study. But before we get going, Ben, anything new happening? Anything you want to let everybody out there know has been going on?
Well, I haven't put nothing out lately on the old Muddy Piston Garage YouTube channel, but there's some videos there if you want to go watch that. We actually went up to Windrock. Should have took some cameras and recorded it, but we didn't. That's an off-road park up around Knoxville, Tennessee. And we had a pretty good time last weekend. Gave me a bunch of ideas to do.
Too many ideas.
To more Jeeps, and my wife's probably going to kill me over that. But, you know, can't take it with you. But, other than that, just, you know, working like normal and doing stuff. What you been into?
Well, not much, buddy. I've been working like crazy. Milan has soccer pretty much every weekend. Been in Knoxville a lot as well. But I do have something that is kind of a big deal to me. It's a lot of pressure. But this Sunday.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, this Sunday, I'm actually, our pastor's on vacation, and I get the privilege of delivering the message on Sunday. So that's for me, it's a very scary thing, but also a very, I feel like it's a step forward in my faith and my walk with God, because, you know, if we should do one thing, we should listen to the Holy Spirit, right?
That's right.
The funny thing is, when I went up to Doug, I actually said it to him probably about 2 months ago. I walked up to him and I said, Doug, I really think God's pushing me to deliver a message at some point if you'd be okay with that. And Doug goes, how soon can you do it? And I'm like, Doug, hold on. Shouldn't you pray about this first or something like that? He goes, we're good. He goes, how soon can you do it? How much time do you need to get ready? I said, a week or so. And then he's like, well, I'll let you know when I'm going on vacation. I said, okay. And that's that's kind of what happened. So,
I'll wear my Ranger panties back here in the back.
Keep me smiling.
And everybody who don't know what Ranger panties are, just Google Ranger panties.
And
it's the military. It's the Army Ranger military PT shorts. It's pretty much where the name Ranger panties came from, but they're pretty short.
They look just like the marathon runners, like the real marathon runner shorts, like real short shorts.
But I could wear them, so the most like weird attention's on me, so it makes it easier for you. I would do that for you.
I don't necessarily think that's a bad idea.
Only once.
Well,
I don't know if I can survive doing it twice. I talk a lot of smack, but I don't think I could do it twice.
Anyway, I think we need to jump into Genesis and get rolling.
Genesis 22.
So we left off talking a little bit about the covenant with Abimelech in 21. Now we're going into kind of a story that is we've heard for a lot of our life. And as a young Christian, a lot of times you look at this and you go, how could this happen? How could this even be an option? But we're going to shed some light on that today, which some of this I've only recently discovered, and it's really actually pretty interesting. So let's jump into chapter 22. Sometime later, God tested Abraham's faith. Abraham, God called. Yes, he replied, here I am. Take your son, your only son, yes, Isaac, whom you love so much, and go to the land of Moriah. Go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will show you. The next morning, Abraham got up early. He saddled his donkey and took two of his servants with him, along with his son Isaac. Then he chopped wood for the fire for a burnt offering and set out to the place that God told him about. On the third day of their journey, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. Stay here with the donkey, Abraham told the servants. The boy and I will travel a little further. We will worship there, and we will come right back. So Abraham placed the wood for the burnt offering on Isaac's shoulders, while he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them walked on together, Isaac turned to Abraham and said, Father. Yes, my son, Abraham replied. We have the fire and the wood, the boy said, but where is the sheep for the burnt offering? God will provide a sheep for the burnt offering, my son, Abraham answered. And they both walked on together. When they arrived at the place where God had told him to go, Abraham built an altar and arranged the wood on it. Then he tied his son, Isaac, and laid him on top of the altar. And Abraham picked up the knife to kill his son as a sacrifice. At that moment, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Yes, Abraham replied, here I am. Don't lay a hand on the boy, the angel said. Do not hurt him in any way, for now I know you truly fear God. You have not withheld even your son, your only son. Then Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. So he took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering in the place of his son. Abraham named the place Yahweh Yaren, which means the Lord will provide. To this day, people still use that name as a proverb. On the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. Then the angel of the Lord called again to Abraham from heaven. This is what the Lord says. Because you have obeyed me and not withheld even your son, your only son, I swear by my own name, I will certainly bless you. I will multiply your descendants beyond number, like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will conquer the cities of their enemies. And through your descendants, all nations of earth will be blessed, all because you have obeyed me. Then they returned to the servants and traveled back to Beersheba, where Abraham continued to live. Soon after this, Abraham heard that Milcah, his brother Nahor's wife, had borne Nahor 8 sons. The oldest was named Uz, the next was Buz, followed by Kemuel, the ancestor of the Arminians, Kesed, Hazo, Pildash, Jiplad, and Bethuel. Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. In addition to these 8 sons from Milcah, Nahor had 4 other children from his concubine, Rama. Their names were Tibah, Gaham, Tahash, and Maacah. And that's chapter 22.
I find it interesting. Up here at the beginning, it says, take your son, your only son. Which we know that Isaac is from Sarah, and the other one, I can't remember his name. Do what?
Ishmael's from Hagar.
Yeah, Ishmael's from Hagar, which was Sarah's, I guess,
it was handmaiden, her Egyptian slave that she gave to Abraham as a wife.
But I wonder if God didn't recognize her as his wife, so therefore Ishmael would be like a bastard son or something.
And that's a good pickup, because the whole point was God had made his covenant, right? His covenant was always, the plan was through Sarah. God had made that covenant with about Isaac, and multiple times he says that.
If you don't know, through Isaac and everything is the Jewish religion, and then through Ishmael is the Muslim religion. It they've separated, and it all goes back to here.
It's where it starts.
And which they, the, if I remember correct, the Muslims still believe in, like, Genesis, you know, the first five books of the Bible. So this is where I'm, or maybe even the whole Old Testament-ish. But it's like, if it literally says, take your son, your only son, then where do they say, well, Ishmael's the firstborn, so, you know, it's not really, you're praying to the wrong God or whatever.
Well, it goes back again, too, to the, and we could say the favor of the younger, too, because David was the younger. You know, if we go back through history, yeah, I always see the oldest son is the one who gets the birthright, these things. But no, Jacob, you know, gets the birthright by tricking his father, Isaac, you know, pretending he's Esau. Then yeah. You have David being the eighth son, you know, in his family line, considered a cursed child. Yet the favor falls on the younger. There's a lot of times that happens, but I truly do think that what you said initially makes more sense, that this is because they didn't follow what God had planned. This was not God's plan when
it wasn't like a sanctioned marriage.
They took it into their own hands to have an heir for Abraham. But now what's really cool, and this is the part where I think everybody struggles, right? We think about Isaac. And we think about this little boy that's taken up there, and he's just wondering what's going on. And then,
well, he can't be little if he's carrying all the firewood on his shoulders.
All right. So this is the thing, right? So, but in our head, this is what we think. Right. We're like a 12-year-old kid that gets up there. And now we have to remember, when Isaac's born, how old's Abraham?
Pretty old.
He's 100.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're talking, if Isaac was 12, whatever. I don't believe that. If you look through the next chapter, the next chapter is about Sarah dying, and Sarah's 127 at that point. She was 90 when he's born. So Isaac could have been anywhere up to 37 years old when that happened. And there's a good chance that Isaac was 20s, 30s when this was all going on. Now, even if you're a teenager, a 100-year-old dude is just going to subdue you and tie you up and put you on an altar?
That, yeah.
No. So this right here is not just Abraham's sacrifice. This is Isaac, too. Isaac was a willing participant. When they got up there, Isaac had to be willing to let himself be bound and placed on that altar.
Well, I also think they're not stupid. You know, well, God'll, you know, he'll give us the sacrifice. Other words, saying we don't have one, you know. Yeah. So it's almost like, okay, well, maybe it's one of us, you know what I'm saying? And he continued to march up. So it is pretty wild,
but it's really cool. So, I mean, maybe the reason that Sarah wasn't talked about until her death, you know, so long after potentially, was because she never talked to Abraham again after he went up to kill her son. But that's neither here nor there.
That could be.
But
what do you mean you tried to?
But the crazy part is, if you look at the beginning when it talks about this, it says, go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering in one of the mountains, which I will show you. Guess what? He doesn't question it. He just says, the next morning, okay, Abraham got up early and saddled up his donkey.
Yeah.
He had faith in God because he knew. Now, this, you could look at this a couple ways. You could think about, like, the way David faced Goliath. David knew Goliath wouldn't kill him because he had not yet been king, because God told him that. Now, God's already told Abraham that Isaac will be through his heir, who all these nations come from.
Right.
So he has faith that somehow this is going to work out. But if you go, this is really cool. I want to pull this up real quick. I think I have it marked in my Bible. But Hebrews 11 actually talks about this in a really cool way. And Hebrews 11:17, it says, It was by faith that Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice when God was testing him. Abraham, who had received God's promises, was ready to sacrifice his only son Isaac, even though God told him, Isaac is the son through whom your descendants will be counted. Abraham reasoned that if Isaac died, God was able to bring him back to life again. And in a sense, Abraham did receive his son back from the dead. So Abraham's actually thinking, well, I might have to go through with this to show my commitment to God, but God's going to bring him back. That's how much faith he had in the fact that it was going to what he was going to go through. And because of God's promises that God was not going to let Isaac be done there. His story was not over.
Right.
So I just think that's really cool that we see that in another section of the Bible where it kind of describes where Abraham's headspace was. But I just think that's funny because we always think of this as a child, you know, with his father, and he's going to sacrifice his kid. Literally, Isaac could have been 32, 36 years old, and he's just like, all right, tie me up, put me on the altar. Because you're not overpowering. I mean, a 100-some-odd-year-old guy is not overpowering Isaac, you know, is not overpowering a younger guy like that. So
In his prime. Yeah.
So we're not 100% sure how old he was, but I will tell you this, is that there's absolutely
He wasn't a child.
And he was willing to be part of this sacrifice. He knew, and I'm sure he knew the prophecy and everything too, that and the covenant God had made saying that he is going to be the father of many nations, you know, because of Abraham. He's the heir that's coming from.
Right. You all right there?
Yeah, I still got a tickle in my throat. I've been just had this cold forever. Couple other cool things. Stop me if you got something. So a couple other cool things is when God calls, right? It says, Abraham, right? And he says, yes, here I am. The word in Hebrew is Hanani. And it literally means I am here. I'm in your presence. I am like, you're totally boom. This is me right here in front of you. It's just kind of a cool way, which if you hear that, you see that in multiple different places throughout the Bible. You see it when Eli tells Samuel, even like God, you know, when he thinks Eli's calling him and he gets up and goes, he's like, no, you're hearing the voice of God. Just say, here I am, Hanani. And so it's just a cool way of saying, yes, I am present with the Lord. So I kind of always like that terminology. It was just kind of cool. And then one other thing that I noticed with this is, you know, he gets up there, he's about to sacrifice his son. And when he's told to stop, he looks up and there's a ram in the thicket, right?
Yeah.
So we got to look at that a couple ways you could look at that. Was that ram just, did God just magically make that ram appear at that moment? Which I don't choose to believe that that's the case. Or was there a veil over Abraham's eyes?
Where he never seen it.
He didn't see it. It was hid from him. God allowed that to have, you know, you have sight.
Yeah. It could be either way, I guess. You know, and also, which I don't know how true it is, but I've heard numerous times that this is the same area where Jesus was crucified, where it was like a foreshadowing of Christ getting crucified. Where he says, I will provide the sacrifice.
And your only son too, right? So it's,
yeah,
he's kind of given them a picture ahead of time.
Yeah. It's a foreshadowing.
But the other part when I was talking about the veil, the last little thing of that, when he names that place, Yahweh, Yireh, or Yireh, something like to that effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
It means on this mountain of the Lord, there is sight. So that veil is lifted, boom, he sees the sacrifices there. So there is a definite connection to that being like the veil being lifted, knowing that, yes, I don't have to sacrifice my son, but this ram is right there in front of me. God always provides. He could have said that. God provides. Oh, he provided a sacrifice. No, God allowed him sight to see that in front of him, that God had provided that sacrifice. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think I'm a little all over the place on that, but I'll tell you this. I've been taking this little course that Hillsdale College does, these free courses. And you can go online, you sign up for a free account, and you can take this free course, and it's like 6-7 hours long, split up into little sections. Justin Jackson breaks down the different, not all of Genesis, but major themes throughout Genesis. And he puts it like he's a literary, I think he's an English teacher most of the time, but he breaks down the poetry and the literary side of it and shows you how the pictures are really painted. He breaks down, I guess it's more of like a literary context that he gives you, so you actually can see how it's written, and the verbiage that you use actually tells half the story. It's not just the words plain and here, you know, it's the whole story that's put out there because of the way that the Hebrew language writes it and depicts it. So he is a professor in English grammar, but doubles up in biblical studies with some of this stuff. But he can take the language and literally kind of break it down and show you, just paint a whole picture for you just the way he says it. And it's such an amazing tool to kind of look through. And this book right here is the book that he kind of uses as the companion to it.
Right.
It's called Genesis Translation and Commentary by Robert Alter. And this is really good. This book really breaks down, goes through each section, and then it'll have a bunch of points underneath about what they're saying here and why they're saying it, and what it means. And it's just, it's really, really well written. I know that was a big side note, but I think it's really important when we look at this, because, you know, we can sit there and read it at face value and God's going to talk to us through the scripture. He always is. But man, I love looking for context and being able to dig in just that next step a little bit further. Is that Proverbs 25:2, it's the glory of God to conceal a thing, and it's the glory of kings to search things out.
Right.
So there's so many things that we can find by looking. But yeah, that dude, he's top notch, and he's got, I'll send you the link to it.
Yeah, that's going to be, I'll have to.
He's got
tons. I mean, they're free, so why not, right?
There are tons of stuff. There's tons of classes on here, but I got my first certificate today for finishing the Genesis one.
Start getting college credits again.
Yeah. I got enough of those. I just want to learn now. I actually want to learn this time around. I didn't want to learn in college.
Yeah, I hear that. You can add that to your, help you with your documentary you're doing.
Well, the documentary is a little bit, it's taken some twists and turns in a very positive way, because the whole goal is for that to be so different than anything else that's been done that it, like an atheist will start watching it, and just because it, the undertones are Christian, they won't just turn it off right away. I want it to capture everybody. That's the point.
Right.
Most of these documentaries are made for believers. Most of these documentaries are just, and they're great information, right. But if I'm not already a believer that's interested in those things, I'm not going to watch it.
No, it might even turn you off to it.
Yeah. So we're trying to find a way to paint a picture for people, to show the truth of what creation is, and to show that through the real human experience that you have a drive, that you have a creator, that, you know, you're not an accident on this planet. It's not just a pure coincidence that you're here. You're created for a reason. You're created in fearfully and wonderfully made to follow through on things God has planned for your life. And that's the whole goal, is to paint that picture without running people away just for, you know.
Without shoving it down their throat, you know.
Yeah, it's not my goal.
Or being just blunt about. You're kind of doing it in a cryptic-ish. You're being blunt, but in a cryptic-ish way.
All right. So
pretty much wraps that one up.
I think, is there anything else on chapter 22 you want to hit?
Not really.
So why don't we jump into chapter 23? When Sarah was 127 years old, she died at Kiriath Arba, which is now called Hebron, in the land of Canaan, where Abraham mourned and wept for her. Then, leaving her body, he said to the Hittite elders, "Here I am, a stranger and a foreigner among you. Please sell me a piece of land so I can give my wife a proper burial." The Hittites replied to Abraham, "Listen, my lord, you are an honored prince among us. Choose the finest of our tombs and bury her there. No one will refuse to help you in this way." Then Abraham bowed low before the Hittites and said, "Since you are willing to help me in this way, be so kind as to ask Ephron, son of Zohar, to let me buy his cave at Machpelah, down at the end of his field. I will pay the full price in the presence of witnesses, so I will have a permanent burial place for my family." Ephron was sitting there among the others, and he answered Abraham as the others listened, speaking publicly before all Hittite elders of the town. "No, my lord," he said to Abraham, "listen to me. I will give you the field and the cave. Here in the presence of my people, I will give it to you. Go and bury your dead." Abraham bowed low before the citizens of the land. He replied to Ephron as everyone listened, "No, listen to me. I will buy it from you. Let me pay full price for the field so I can bury my dead there." Ephron answered Abraham, "My lord, please listen to me. The land is worth 400 pieces of silver, but what is that between friends? Go ahead and bury your dead." So Abraham agreed to Ephron's price and paid the amount he had suggested, 400 pieces of silver, and weighed according to the market standard. The Hittite elders witnessed the transaction. So Abraham bought the plot of land belonging to Ephron at Machpelah near Mamre. This included the field itself and the cave that was in it and all the surrounding trees. It was transferred to Abraham as his permanent possession in the presence of the Hittite elders at the city gate. Then Abraham buried his wife Sarah there in Canaan in the cave at Milpella near Mamre, also called Hebron. So the field and the cave were transferred from the Hittites to Abraham to use as his permanent burial place. And that's chapter 23. Now, I see a couple things in here. I don't know how much these Hittites knew, because he's in the land that God's promising the Israelites in the long run, right? His descendants are going to take over that land.
Right.
Do these Hittites know about that covenant? I'm not sure, because the way that they answer him, or the way that they're
calling him like a lord and
a prince among them. But I got a feeling, and it's actually, like I said, watch some of this stuff that guy's that I've been telling you about, that
right.
Justin Jackson. But I got a feeling that this is a little more sarcastic in nature when they're saying it, because if you go down to where he's talking to Ephron, Abraham first asks, "Can you ask Ephron if I can buy that cave?" Then Ephron introduces the land and the cave. He's like, no. We're going to add all this together, right? This isn't like he's doing him a favor. This is a business
transaction. Trying to run up the cost on him.
So
if you want it, you're going to pay for it.
When we get down to 400 pieces of silver, that was an exorbitant amount. I mean,
well, he also says, "And what is that amongst friends?"
Yeah.
Like it's chump change.
Well, and that's the whole point, is he's,
but it's not chump change.
No, he actually gouged Abraham, but Abraham said, "I'll pay whatever the price is, whatever you want,
right?
Full price." And even though he was gouging him, and the way that they approached him, and I can hear this conversation, and it's snarky and condescending towards Abraham, like, There's already a hatred there that will eventually, you know, come because of his children, right? So we're talking about the land of Canaan and down, you know, this is down through after the Exodus, they come in and they just start wiping out all these other tribes. And a lot of those that come from the other side of the family.
Yeah.
So you see that there's a, there's already like an animosity there between them. And I just find that really interesting that, you know, when we read this stuff, and it helps, once again, I'm reading the NLT. So we're looking at a translated, easier to read version, but I think we mix and we miss some of the contextual clues sometimes when we read some of these easier to read texts. Not saying that they're wrong or they're inaccurate, but we're not reading it in the Hebrew, so we're missing some of the. It sounds like he's trying to be really nice to him. Oh, I'll just give it to you. But really, when you look all along, why would he say, my Lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 pieces of silver. But what's that? Like,
yeah.
He's just saying like, oh, you can have it. Sounds like he's being nice, but why bring up this is what the land's really worth?
Almost saying like, oh, what's that to me? I'm filthy rich and you have nothing. What's that? That amongst friends? That's just whatever.
But it's a very condescending way, it seems, that he's approached.
Well, this here's what else I find funny. So it was transferred to Abraham as his permanent possessions in the presence of the Hittite elders at the city gate. You're going to make a transaction. Where do you make it at? Your office area? You're going to sit down. You're going to write something up. You're going to, you know, at a desk, at a lawyer's office, you know, at the courthouse, which obviously that's language of today's world, but
it's actually interesting. It's
almost like, we'll just don't even come in the city. We'll just meet you at the gate.
It's actually
kicking them out as they're giving it to them. Just get out of here.
Let me see this.
I don't
part.
Know, but that's just kind of stuck out at me. It's like, why would they do it at the gate?
There's a thing here talking about, and I read this earlier. Okay, here. So it says, in the hearing of the Hittites, all assembled in the gate of his town. Legal business was conducted in the gateway. The men assembled there constitute.
Kind of like an altar kind of thing?
It's not like a kind of town council.
Or not an altar, but like an arbor?
Something to that effect. So it says, scholarship has abundantly observed that the actual language used by Ephraim and Abraham and the narrator bristles with the set terms familiar from other ancient Near Eastern documents for the conveyance of property, meaning that a lot of times the gateway was where these things were actually performed, okay. Which I never ever would have thought that until I read that today.
That's pretty wild. I guess what I was trying to say, like the threshold.
Yeah.
How back in the day, the threshold was, and now it's kind of more like your hearth on your fireplace, mm-hmm. But originally it was like the threshold of your house.
Yeah. That was that Vicky Joy episode.
We had a thing on it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's wild.
But yeah, that, I think that's really interesting, but I think, and that's, if you see, you know, Abraham throughout the text, he's like, I'm a stranger in a foreign land, right? Yeah. He's in a place where he doesn't feel welcome. Obviously, he doesn't feel like he's part of there, even though
he's an outcast kind of thing.
But God's taken him there to show him this is the land that has been promised to his descendants. And I don't know. It's just, it's cool because God always seems to have a story within a story that's pointing towards the next story. And the way that God tells a story, everything is interconnected. It's woven together. And the text always strengthens the text down the way, right?
Yeah.
Like you talked about with the symbolism between him going to sacrifice Isaac is a lot like, okay, you're going to give up your son. And the verbiage said over and over again, even though it wasn't truly his only son, said his only son.
Right.
The verbiage is showing, you're going to sacrifice your only son. And it was a mirror image of what Jesus eventually did for us on the cross. So he paints those pictures. He gives us hints. This is what's coming. He's showing us the future of our salvation, but he does it in little snippets and little pictures that a lot of times we don't see until, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah. But, and it's even as you grow in your faith, like when I was 16 years old, I've been like, whatever. He bought some land. Okay, cool. Next. Mm-hmm. You know, why am I even reading this? But now as we've grown a little bit, it's okay. You know, and it even gets more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back then, like, oh, what is this even talking about? You know, but like the gate, just like we discussed about the gate, like who would have, you know, unless you dig into it and look at it and kind of figure it out, then it's like, okay, so, you know, it shows that they're actually an actual culture. It's just not some guy randomly, you know, it was in front of all the elders. So it was a legitimate purchase. It wasn't like he could go back and say, oh, he just took the land. That's illegitimate, whatever.
It's like having a notary.
It's like proven. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. You're right. All the elders were there. And
we still use that on forms, right? You fill something out. You need a witness. Notary. You need a witness. So you always have a witness sign off on things just to prove it happened. But
it's pretty wild.
I love it. I tell you, every time we get into Genesis and we look at things, and I read these, you know, I've read this before. I know these stories. We know about this, but I've never thought of the fact until more recently going through those courses and whatnot, actually thinking, Isaac, like, how is a 100-some-year-old dude overpowering a you know, a kid and tying him up and throwing him on the altar? Unless Abraham's just jacked, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, who, like, how are you overpowering this kid? And then the kid's just like, all right, like, if I'm that 12-year-old kid, he ties me up, throws me on the altar, I'm rolling off. I'm trying to get wherever I can to get away and trying to run back home to mama to protect me. But he was a willing participant. He was part of it. He was showing his faith as well. And I think that's such a cool way to see that it wasn't just, this isn't just Abraham, because the covenant continues on through Isaac and eventually through Jacob and through the 12 tribes that come from him. So, and it does say, and we read through that all nations will be blessed because of that. All nations. So
which
he's not
also, yeah,
it's and all it of was us.
It was his faith to do that particular event is what sparked, you know, if he didn't go through with it, well, then what would have happened then? You know, it was his actually, okay, well, like you're saying, like David, well, I ain't king yet, so let's give her a whirl and see what happens. So that's pretty darn wild.
All right, man. Yes, well, I sir. Love it. Well, everybody out there who's listening, we appreciate you coming along for the ride. And as we always say,
keep digging.